Today's episode of the Open Pantry podcast is brought to you by me, Sean from Open Pantry Consulting. Make sure if you're opening a restaurant or starting to scale your restaurant that you come and check out what I'm doing at openpantryconsulting.com. Everything around operations analysis, recruitment, or data analytics. Everything to get your restaurant, cafe, or bakery on the better side of this crisis. Let's keep going with the show. Guys, welcome to another podcast. But before we get into it, I really want to talk to you about Restoke, which is a revolutionary back of house automation platform, which is purpose built for hospitality and developed with one core belief in mind. That is that time is a business owner's most valuable asset and it should be reclaimed using tech and data. And you know how much we've been talking about that over the last few months since the crisis of COVID. Tech and data is so important for hospitality owners moving forward. The Restoke team have set out to make sure that your restaurant runs smoother with better operations and an easy to use setup and platform that's beneficial for both single site and multi-location organizations. At the end of the podcast, tune in for a second little bit of this episode and we'll talk about how you can get Restoke in your venue with a special subscription offer. But for now, let's get into the program. Welcome to another Open Pantry podcast. It's so good to have you on the show. So thanks for tuning in. As you would know by now, one of my most important topics that I've talked about this year has been talking about supply chain and food insecurity. So it's a pleasure to have our next guest on from an organization called SDG2 Advocacy Hub, which is bringing together NGOs, agricultural networks, nutritionists, campaigners, civil society and private sector, and UN agencies to coordinate advocacy efforts and achieve this by 2030. We're actually going to ask our next guest what the hell that even means. But it is really ambitious because they have promised to end hunger, achieve food security, and improve nutrition and promote sustainable agriculture. It's great to have Paul Newham, the director of this great advocacy hub, on the program today. So welcome, Paul. Thanks so much for being a guest. It's great to have you on.
No, absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's great to be on. So
awesome. Yeah. So let's talk about first what SDG2 actually means to start out with. But I'd love you to talk about your career as well, because when we first got chatting a couple of months ago, it was a conversation which I knew was going to be good, but I was blown away by your career and the effort that you are doing for food security around the world, and it was just really, really enlightening conversation. So let's talk about what that actually means and how you actually started out.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, it is a bit of a mouthful, SDG2 Advocacy Hub, mm-hmm. and that was partly intentional. Mm-hmm. You know, we are a network. We're running a network which sits behind many of the organizations to help them to be effective. And so, you don't necessarily then want to create a very catchy brand that everyone kind of starts using, because then that undermines the network that you're actually trying to drive forward.
Yeah.
So, but first, I think it's important just to kind of frame up what the SDGs are.
Yes.
So, essentially, this is a set of goals that was established in 2015. There's actually 17 of these goals. Mm-hmm. And so SDG2 is one of the 17.
Right.
These goals were created at the United Nations and mm-hmm. signed by every country of the world in the world. And basically, the way I kind of describe it is, it's a plan that the world leaders all got together on mm-hmm. to say, here's the agenda globally for the next 15 years of all the things we really need to work on together.
Yes.
And so it covers things around, you know, poverty, food issues, gender, environment, climate change, urbanization, energy. So it goes into all these kinds of areas. And this is not the first time the world's done this. In the year 2000, they created a thing called the Millennium Development Goals.
Right.
The Millennium Development Goals were a set of goals to try and help bring together that agenda.
Yes.
And they went for 15 years. But in 2015, they decided we've learned some stuff from that first 15 years. Some things we hit, some things we didn't. Let's reset them, but let's look at them as an integrated connection of issues, because what they learned was that you can't just solve one issue without it kind of causing unintended consequences on others. And so there's this interrelationship. And that also an issue like, so Sustainable Development Goal 2 is all around food, agriculture, nutrition, biodiversity, but the tagline is zero hunger. And it's not just zero hunger. And so what they also realized is that you can solve a problem, but you can also create others. And so you have to have integrated targets under each of these goals that can be measurable to ensure that we end up with the right kind of development. And so essentially that's this big framework. It's worth checking out. It's called the Sustainable Development Goals. You can type it into Google, or the other way it's sometimes referred to is the Global Goals.
Okay.
And so, and that's a little more accessible. That's kind of a whole piece of work that's been done to kind of help make that accessible. And so I got into this. So I grew up in Melbourne and had parents that lived and worked all around the world. So I was in Asia and Africa as a child, and so kind of grew up with this kind of worldview. And initially out of school, wasn't quite sure what to do, ended up doing an arts degree at Monash, which is a good starting point for anyone who's not sure what to do.
Yes.
And studied Indigenous studies and world religion. And,
wow. You know,
really interesting, but career path very complicated.
Yes.
So started out in that space, ended up then doing that and a range of other things. Ended up working into, particularly with young people, on engaging them about global issues. Ended up at World Vision and worked there for a number of years on things like the 40-hour famine.
Yeah.
And then moved around within World Vision into kind of the I studied then development at RMIT. I did a whole range of other stuff. And then ended up working on the communications marketing side, which was always like a paradox for me, because I was always about the programming side, but then I'd get offered jobs on the other side.
Yeah.
And so worked through that in different roles in different parts of the world. And really, I suppose, saw lots of great work, lots of innovation, lots of complex challenges that were out there, and tried to work on how do we work through that, working with communities and community development as a space is essentially learning how do you help communities discover answers to their own problems.
Yes. So there's self-sufficiency in a way.
So you go to university and you kind of, it's about getting slapped, you know, like, so you sit in your classes and you sort of try and go, oh, I know what you should do, and then they're like, slap. No, you don't. You don't know about this context or this culture or this. And so it's more about then going, how do you sit with a community, listen, engage, and help them uncover things that maybe are solutions to their own problems and connect them with resource and opportunity, or help them problem solve how to take them to scale. And so I did a lot of that, and that makes you kind of quite reflective and also about how do you connect dots. Fast forward, I kind of ended up living and working in all different parts of the world, in Latin America, in East Africa, in Europe, in North America, lived in different parts as well.
Wow.
And about 2016, I decided, look, I've been working for World Vision in different roles for a long time, inside and outside the organization, like doing the innovative edge, trying to kind of stretch and shift thing, and then also outside. And I was like, I need to probably just take a bit of a reset and say, where am I going? Am I going to stay here forever? It's a very big organization and there's a lot to do.
Yes.
Or do I do something different? And so I said, okay, I'm going to take the jump and I'm going to jump out. And the plan was to travel for a year. Ended up 13 days later working in Rome with the World Food Program, doing a consultancy there. And that kind of opened this whole new pathway. We started working with some chefs in Peru, Gaston Acurio, and started working on anemia with the president, and this kind of like, how do we address these issues through working with people on the culinary side?
Yes.
And then I went back into Rome and they said, would you be interested in helping, given your experience, work on setting up this network to really accelerate how we work forward? They said, basically, there's a lot of great technical work going on. There's a lot of good policy work, but this food system conversation is not necessarily breaking through at the top level. It kind of doesn't necessarily mainstream. And this was back 2017. Issues like water, you know, gender, diversity, you know, there's lots of other issues out there around, you know, health and other things that are kind of breaking through on the global level. But, you know, food and agriculture, nutrition is always kind of not quite getting there.
Yes.
So how do we think about that differently? And so we basically sat down, I moved to the UK and had to sort of set up this startup to try and bring together these big organizations into some sort of convening, coordinating, coalescing kind of group. We incubated under a UN agency, which, to be honest, is not the easiest thing. You know, UN agencies can be quite bureaucratic. They deal with governments. They deal at that level. And so trying to kind of register domain names and things like that when you're kind of like a little startup, there's a lot of process to go through, but it was good. I mean, it was a good learning. And so anyway, we launched that and got it going. And so the network now has been going for a good 4 years and is growing. And so we bring together people into conversations. We kind of develop narratives and move that forward. And we've built a chef's network as part of that called the Chef's Manifesto, which was looking at a framework for how chefs can engage in the sustainable development goals. And so that's now in 80 countries and, you know, things are continuing to grow. So it's been a journey.
It's been an absolute journey. Out of all the, I'm not sure if I asked you this last time we spoke, but of all the countries you've, you know, lived and worked in, is there kind of a favorite that stands out? Is there a culture, is there a people which just resonates with you more than anyone else? Or does that sort of change? Or do you constantly have like a top three of like places that you've lived that you love the most? Or
yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there's what I suppose I've come to like different places for different reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's mainly because you get familiar with them. Like I always reflect on this idea of it's such a weird world we live in,
yes,
where you know you have local neighborhood favorites and walking tracks and in random cities around the world. And yes, sometimes they're random neighborhoods of cities that for some reason there was an office there, a hotel you liked, a friend you met, and you kind of got to know that community in a different way.
Yes.
And so there's a number of places like that where I would go regularly back to over time working on projects. And so depending on the city, like I spent quite a bit of time in Nairobi, for example, and I really enjoyed this part of Nairobi on the outskirts. And I kind of got to know the local restaurants, the local parks, met people in different places. And I'm a bit of a creature of habit when I travel because if I find a place that works for me, I just want to keep going back there. I just don't want to go try a new hotel every time or whatever.
So
it's just easy and familiar and you kind of know what you're getting into.
Yes.
When change is happening all the time. So, you know, Nairobi's got a special place in my heart. Lebanon's also a really interesting place. I really enjoyed my time in Lebanon. I think it was the people and the culture and the food.
Yes.
All combined.
Yes.
Lebanon's very intense, like in Beirut particularly. It's a very intense city, but it's also very multicultural, similar to Melbourne in many ways. You have all different faiths, all different cultures, all kind of meshed in this very intense space. But it's also, you know, a very challenged space. You know, people have been very generous with refugees. They have some of the most refugees of anywhere in the world at the moment. It has kind of some quite challenging, harsh, in-your-face realities to deal with. But then you see how people gather as families and friends around, you know, iftar and food and, you know, and celebrate. And it's just amazing and it's beautiful and it's human, you know? So, I mean, that's, I love that. There's lots of other places. I've lived in the UK. So London's an amazing city and there's some great spots in London. New York, I've spent a lot of time in, but then, you know, places, you know, in, you know, the middle of nowhere that also you kind of get familiar with, you know, yes. The coast of Kenya, I've spent quite a bit of time and you kind of have friends there that I went and saw every 3 months. And so you kind of build these relationships and it's just an odd place. You'd probably never go there unless you were doing, it's not big on the tourist destination yet, but it probably will be in the future, you know, so.
You talked a bit, you said just before how things like water, you know, and diversity and stuff weren't really cutting through sort of at the top level. You would have a distinct understanding as to why that is. Is it because there's some bureaucracy there or you know, what are the challenges and why, you know, we are setting these amazing targets every 15 years and trying to push the needle, you know, even further, but at some point it's not cutting through at the top level. Do you have any understanding as to why that is?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's lots of reasons why issues don't come through. I think sometimes it's clarity of message. So you have within sectors, especially that get very technical.
Yes.
There's a difference. So the political realities that we find ourselves in now in most parts of the world, require a kind of different engagement. So it used to be good policy was what drove governments on both sides of the fence to make decisions.
Yes.
So, and good policy was based on science. It was based on generally agreed facts.
Fact, yeah.
And we now live in a world where fact, science, everything is questioned, everything is up for grab and it grabs and everything can be pulled apart and you can see a reasonable thread to justify most positions on both sides. You know, the media, you know, really shapes this, social media, you know, the echo chamber that we can find ourselves in through algorithms and, you know, all of this.
Yes.
And so within that world that we find ourselves in, politics is no different. So when you come to the top level of politics, you have leaders who have to really react to the public opinion.
Yes.
And public opinion that's not like we did a study, we called 100,000 households and we did a study and a week later we published it. It's public opinion that is live on Twitter trending based on disapproval of what someone said 5 minutes ago. And within that world, there's a lot of ways to manipulate the story.
Yes.
And so issues then become hard to actually get to the bottom of. And so when you have technical answers to complex problems,
yes,
it's hard for them to cut through. And so, you know, people misunderstand science, they don't trust it, they question it, they kind of take a Facebook post is as credible as like the head of CSIRO, you know.
Yes.
And it's like, really? You know, that person went to, you know, study for, and I don't know the head of CSIRO's CV, but my assumption is they're expert level and they have great science.
Yes.
And so, you know, I think part of the challenge we face is to communicate in ways that bring in everyday people to solutions that can connect to multiple issues.
Yes.
So, for example, if we, there's a lot of work on food where you kind of debate and people are now really excited about the connections with climate, you know, so they understand that how we eat and what we eat, not everyone, has a direct correlation to the environment and climate.
Yes.
And so if you believe in climate change, which is also an up for grabs kind of conversation in some markets, if you believe in climate change, then you go, it's very plausible that the way we produce food en masse probably has some impact on that.
Yes.
So thus me, I can make choices around what I do about it.
Mm.
And so some people will then go, okay, climate, food, connection, that makes sense. And that's starting to come, you know, whereas like at the climate action summits at the global level, food is now starting to be discussed as a contributor. And like there was a study that came out in one of the top science magazines just recently, which said, you know, if we cut our emissions, cut all our emissions like down to almost zero, we still don't hit the Paris Agreement unless we address our food system. It's our food system has one of the biggest impacts on our climate in its current form. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of then make some of these connections, but then some of the reactions to fighting climate change are focused just on better for planet.
Yes.
And then they don't think about the human health element.
Yes.
And human health 100%. Is also in crisis. Mm. So in the space that I'm in, you know, we talk a lot about like the hard issue is, you know, there's over 800 million people that go to bed hungry without the right nutrients in a world that produces enough food to feed 1.5 times the planet.
Yes.
Maybe two, depending on who's doing the study.
Yeah.
But then you've got 2 billion people facing some form of food insecurity. Mm. And then yet we waste huge amounts of food.
Mm.
And then also in certain areas where we've been seeing some declines in some of the hunger in certain countries, but then we've seen obesity levels and overweight move up at double the speed.
Yes.
So we're kind of doing this kind of going, creating another problem. Mm. So you kind of see these are complex problems and human health, like what's good for people and what's good for the planet and sometimes not being lined up. So one of the things we're doing is going, how do you create good food for all? How do you create a platform and define what food is, that what's good about food? Well, food can be good for people and it can be good for our planet.
Yes.
And if we do that in a way that's also based on technical science, so there's science that proves all of this.
Yes.
You know, like what nutritional makeup we should have, that we should eat more diverse diets. I mean, this has been going on forever.
Yes.
And yet our diets become less diverse. You know, I think four crops now make up 60% of all combined calories that everyone eats in the world.
Wow.
You know, so you've got this, you know, huge, as the food system's improved, our diversity has gone down in what we eat. There's like 30,000 edible plants in the world and we eat 150 in the majority of our diets. Now, if you think about it, you know, I was doing something on one of these health apps and they were asking me how many veggies I eat each day. And, you know, I'm like, I think you have to eat more than 5. I'm eating like 15, but, you know, that's because we've changed the way we do it, you know.
Yes.
But I'm even thinking about that and going, well, that's not that diverse. You know, that's a lot for your refrigerator in suburban Melbourne to kind of have 15 to 20 different ingredients there.
Yeah. But in the grand scheme of things,
when there's 30,000 in the world, what am I missing out on? You know, you know, and so there's things like this where connecting the technical to the public narrative to then a political narrative that like a minister of finance, a minister, you know, the prime minister can kind of deal with.
Yeah.
You either relegate yourself to like the agriculture and the health minister, and in health, like nutrition and food, it's tiny. Like they deal with so many other issues. You know, I think in most countries, doctors don't have, they have 0 to 10 days on nutrition.
Mm.
So nutrition, even though food is one of the biggest contributors to non-communicable disease, cancer rates, all these kinds of things, doctors, the connection between nutrition and food and health is very limited and not necessarily at the level it should. So there's lots of these kinds of issues that I think even just what I'm explaining is it's just so complex.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think Western countries especially understand food insecurity? Because I mean, it is so bountiful in countries like ours. Like, do you think we really get it and understand what food insecurity for people around the world actually is?
So I think increasingly, yes.
Mm.
But I think what there is greater inequality within countries.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you look at most places around the world since the COVID-19 issue, you would see number of people that feel So there was a study done by the Food and Agriculture Organization every year that's called the SOFI report. And one of the things they've done in the last 2 or 3 years is a new component, which is about perceived in food insecurity. So it's like asking people, surveying en masse at every country level, how do you feel you have food security? So it's more of a perception.
Yes.
But what that shows is that there is actually more insecurity than we think. And like, I mean, I was watching something on an SBS just the other day about food insecurity in Australia. And, you know, there were people talking about, you know, there was a couple of examples of a mother who had 4 kids, unemployed, trying, you know, and she was sort of talking about having like $100, $119 a fortnight to feed 5 to 6 people. And, you know, out of that, she had to pay back a small loan that she had at zero interest for a computer, for a kid that needed it for school, from the Salvation Army, you know. And so you look at that, and so the presenter was saying, so what do you eat? And they said, well, it's UHT milk, right, and it's Weet-Bix. Right. And that's essentially all we can get. You know, that's kind of enough to give us the calories that we need to kind of function.
Right.
Others that, and, you know, she said, I keep applying for jobs, but I'm, you know, in my 40s. Yeah,
it's more of a challenge. I'm
competing at McDonald's with people that are 17.
Yep.
And so, you know, it's a weird world. So I would say for the majority of people, they have no idea.
Yep.
Depending on where they are in a society. So I think there's much more discrepancy in a society. I'd say somewhere like the US, you know, homelessness is way more visible now.
Yeah.
Unemployment has gone through the roof. You know, you're seeing lines at food banks that go, and that's the same. I mean, Australia's not that different. If you talk to certain groups, you know, with OzHarvest and other groups that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you've got lots of discrepancies around the inequality margins.
What do you think we can do that? Maybe explain what, you know, you're doing to try and help change that. But like, maybe we'll talk about that first. I want to talk about what people listening to this can do. But like, let's talk about, you know, what you're doing to help change that, because I know you're doing so much, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a range of things that we're working on. So we, at one level, are working to kind of help connect the dots. So yes, we believe that if you have a more joined up conversation consistently, based on agreed science, using similar language, then you're going to have better chance of getting your message across to the public, but also to governments and decision makers. And that's also private sector, which have a big role to play here. So it's a consistency and a connecting, you know. And so we do that through creating narratives, through creating forums, through creating dialogues that push the envelope, but then also work behind the scenes on strategy, on coaching, on all kinds of things.
Yes.
In terms of what's going on this coming year, there's so as we go into 2021, there's some really big moments that are coming up to try and drive this. So the Secretary General last year called for a UN food systems summit. And so Antonio Guterres has calling for this summit, similar to the climate summit that happened last year. That's a high level summit to bring together governments to say we need to address, look at food systems as a way of addressing our overall development agenda and the issues in the world.
Yep.
And the idea of this is to accelerate new initiatives, game-changing ideas that can be taken at scale, to stimulate a dialogue and a discussion around food systems as a avenue to bring about change.
Yes.
And so this has been called, it's going to be happening in 2021. It will be in a couple of different parts, the actual physical gatherings, depending on the current reality, but it's going to be in the second half of the year. So the high level meeting will be in September alongside the UN General Assembly with heads of state.
Wow.
And then there'll be a more technical meeting in Italy at the end of their summer leading into that. But it's a conversation that started now. And so there's different streams being run to feed into this. So there's a science group that's been convened to look at the science, and there's people from all over the world, including in Australia, mm-hmm. in that science technical group.
Cool.
Then there's a thing called the UN Food System Summit Dialogues, which are being convened. And these are discussions happening in every country in the world in different formats. One will be convened by at a government level, like a national level,
yep.
that will be to talk about what can we do in our country. Mm-hmm. There'll then be dialogues that happen around global events, which are more in between countries.
Yes.
And then there'll also be a toolkit for people to run their own dialogues. Mm. So if you want to, you know, you host a community, a network or whatever, you could host a dialogue. And if you do it in the right way, the outputs will be fed into this process.
Right. I see.
And then the last bit is there's two last bits. One is they've created some action tracks around key areas or key groups or things that they believe can change. And so one of them is like around shifting consumption habits and the way, you know, another's around good food for all and food for all and how do we address some of the hunger. There's something around livelihoods. There's something around nature positive production, mm-hmm. you know. And so then within that, there's groups of people working on what are the solutions, what are the discussions, what are the ideas, and there's public forums to engage and all kinds of elements there.
Yep.
So I think that is going to be a key moment next year, and it's a key moment for anyone to engage in.
Yes.
You can go online, you can share your ideas. They're looking for food system heroes, mm-hmm. At the local level that can do things in their local community, but also raise the awareness of this conversation that our food system is broken. Well, it functions in a way that is not good for the planet or us.
Yes.
And so we need to reform that in a way that actually contributes to the kind of world we want to live in and the kind of human health and planetary health that we want. And so that involves local, national, global change. So there's that, there's a whole range of other stuff, but I think, you know, you were asking about individual levels. So how does that work? And I think, you know, at the individual level, it's about connecting choices. You know, I can talk about what that's meant for me. Obviously I work on this stuff, but you know, I believe there's a strong connection point between what you talk about and advocate on and the integrity you have in the choices you make yourself.
Absolutely.
Like there's no point going out there telling people you should be doing this and then yes. you go and don't do it.
Mm.
So, you know, one of the things I have learned through talking to a lot of scientists is that there's certain parts of the world where diets have to shift. Mm. The way that we eat and what we eat is out of whack with our share.
Okay.
So, you know, in certain parts of the world, for example, on animal-based proteins, certain countries, Europe, North America, Australia probably fits into it, New Zealand,
yes,
eat way too much animal-based proteins for their fair share of a planet. So if everyone yep. caught up to what we eat proportionally,
yes,
the planet blows up, you know, it overheats because we can't, you know, protect our environment as well as. So then there's one of two things. We either need to reduce what we eat so others can have some, yep. or we need to shift what we do. So my view is, you know, there's some parts of the world where people need some of the animal-based proteins because mm-hmm. they need the nutritional makeup. They yep. need that. So we need to eat less. We just need to shrink what we eat. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a choice we've made is to go plant-based on the whole.
Mm-hmm.
We'll occasionally have some fish, occasionally have something, you know, it's not, we're not militant about it,
yes.
but we've just reduced dramatically. So whenever we will always choose plant-based dishes, we will always cook plant-based dishes.
Yes.
And people say that's like super complex when you've got a family, like we've got four kids. It's actually not at all. It's actually super easy. You
yes.
just, we, the kids have meat maybe two nights a week
yep.
Of some sort. They used to have it six nights a week,
yes. you know,
but then other things we just shift. It's just a shift. And then we also, I think one of the science, you know, is build diversity. So how do we build diversity into our diets? We eat way more seeds and nuts, way more leafy greens, way more different vegetables. How do you source that? You try and, you know, organic is great and I'm a big believer in it, but it's also not accessible for everyone.
Yes.
So where we prefer to find things that are organic, that are also affordable. If not, we try and find ways to buy stuff locally. We try and work on knowing where our food comes from and educating people about it. You know, we've just moved back to Australia. We've got vegetables all in the garden going crazy at the moment. And
amazing.
Hopefully if the possums don't get them, you know, we're going to be in good shape to, you know, supplement our, and I think growing food is a really important thing individuals can do because it creates food empathy. You understand then what farmers put into it. You understand the process of where food comes from.
Yes.
And so you then have a very different engagement with it. If you're composting, you know, that captures carbon, like people don't realize, but that actually puts carbon back in the soil, which is really important for us all to do in different ways. And it's so simple and it's kind of fun. Like you can kind of get compost and do that at the local level. Sure, you've got a green bin. Sure, the council does that. But, you know, you can do that even in a small apartment with a little mini work. Like, you know, there's all these kinds of things and soil is so critical. So there's lots of things we can do. We can then also support and use our voice to support, you know, calling on things to be better for people and planet. And I think then make choices also at the supermarket around what do we buy? And that's getting educated a little bit. It's like looking at labels. It's understanding what's there. It's very easy to get on bandwagons on this, you know, and not really understand it. Like, you know, palm oil is bad. So all palm oil we write off. Well, then you go to Nigeria and you talk to someone and they go, local communities are now not eating, you know, red palm oil, which has got nothing to do with orangutans because there's no orangutans in Nigeria. And it's very healthy. And all of a sudden they think they're going to harm the orangutans through eating some indigenously grown native, you know, palm oil that they've had for years. So you've got to understand the complexities of our food system. And so part of it is reading, educating. You know, there's lots of cool books out there to read. I'm just thinking of what I've been reading. One that I read is Bea Wilson's The Way We Eat Now. Bea's really interesting about just how do you think about that. Caroline Steele writes some really good books that connect kind of history of food and then the reality. There's like, this is another one that I'm reading. These are just all on my desk at the moment, but Hungry, which is by Eve Thoreau-Paul. And that really looks at, you know, how do we find connection and meaning in food and how can we use that and tap that in to bring about change? And so looking at the connection between climate and food and how we're going about it a little bit wrong, you know, but why are people going to avocado toast for $35 for breakfast every day? And is that bad or is that actually good? And how do you think about that? So,
Is it a challenge with all these inputs going into something like, you know, the UN summit next year, and then countries, you know, coming out and say we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and then you know, I feel that bipartisan politics doesn't happen as much anymore because at the end of the day, like I want your input on this, but there needs to be policy reform around this area for it to change fundamentally, as well as great organisations like yourself doing fantastic work, putting pressure, educating, you know, the public. Is it a challenge that you have these fantastic summits, 15-year goals, and then you get government change and maybe a change in policy or direction on things like agriculture or things like climate change research or, you know, food insecurity, you know, at either, you know, federal, state or local level, Paul? Like, is it hard to sort of play, you know, on both sides and try to affect government change?
Yeah, I mean, it is. I think that, I mean, it is very challenging to do that. Because what often happens is, like the food systems are super complex. So they require complexity to fix them. Do you know what I mean? Like they require multi-pronged approaches.
Exactly.
When you start to simplify things down, governments go, oh, okay, so we need a sugar tax or we need a this, you know. And so what often happens is the original intent gets simplified into a very narrow response, which then can have unintended consequences.
Yeah, great point.
And so, you know, even if you think about the big game changers of the past, like things like the Green Revolution. So the Green Revolution, Norman Borlaug, you know, at the time when he started looking at this, there was food insecurity in every part of the world. There would be lean seasons in between harvest times and not enough food produced globally to feed everyone. And so Norman looked at how do we accelerate, like he had a very clear focus, how do we accelerate growth? And so they, you know, I think it's something like managed to get rice production in India five times, you know, and all of a sudden you just get then that brings price down, increases volume. Now, part of the reason we have a lack of biodiversity is because we got so efficient at producing certain crops at price. So there's this like swings and roundabouts. Now, that's an unintended consequence. Should we have not done it? Absolutely not. Could he have done it differently? Maybe, but it's a pretty damn impressive goal, you know, to what he did and achieved. And so I believe, you know, in looking at that. So when we think about change, it's going to have to be these big initiatives, but it's also going to have to be looking for things that achieve more than one thing. And so I'm, you know, often that's why we've kind of been playing with this idea of people and planet rather than just like this is planet friendly and this is people friendly and as if that's a choice. Because the people can't function on a planet that the doesn't support them. Thing. And the planet, who cares if we've got a great planet with no people? Like, so I kind of look at just basic ways of saying, does this help? You know, is it? You know, is a plant-based alternative burger that's trying to help you give a better climate impact, adding more calories and less nutrient dense? Well, then, okay, I made the plant a better choice for the planet,
but it was a choice for myself.
Harming myself in the process? Well, that doesn't make sense to me. So I'm like, when I talk to companies that are working on that, I say you should be doing both and you should be looking at maybe three or four areas where you're actually kicking goals, and that's real innovation. Don't tell me about wow, this saves, you know, this has this climate impact, and then feel good and go, okay, we've achieved it.
Well, yes,
because you're transforming people from eating this to eating this. It's, you know, it's around nutrient density is another one. You know, one of the things that recently we found is, you know, you try and get people to eat broccoli, for example, just as an example. And then you find the broccoli, because of the way it's produced, has no nutrients in it. And you're like, oh, you know, because it's been stored forever and it's been, you know, or the way it's been cooked, you know. So this is where we've got to be much more complex. It's not just one size fits all.
So do you think it's up to government to then, because we're really just talking about education, right? Like as part of that, we're talking about education. And policy, like, do you think it's up to government then to really put more money into and more effort into the food in the food system, the agricultural system, everything which hits that, and actually make some common threads and a common narrative that we're going to talk about as a society, and we're going to say, okay, we're going to you know, potentially just do farming this way because this is important, and we're going to support farmers to actually make sure they can do that agriculturally properly for yield and for nutrition density and all that kind of stuff, because we know that if we feed our community well, then that's going to have so many other positive attributes for a society. Like,
Look, I think it's having a common vision. So what's the food system for? So if we, like, if you think the food system's for driving the economy, or if you think the food system's for people's health, or if you think the food system's for driving agricultural, you know, like, depending on what your vision is, depends on what we'll prioritize. So I agree that, the narrative needs to have a common vision, and then it needs to be informed by science on how to achieve that vision.
Totally.
So, you know, there was a report that just came out recently called the Series 2030 report. And it was a study on what are we going to need to do to achieve SDG 2. And it was funded funded by the German government and Gates Foundation and released in the in Nature in a series of articles. And it's a really interesting report. But it talks about the fact that if we're to get back on track, we're going to have to see a doubling of overseas development assistance and, and where that money's got to go, which is $14 billion more a year between now and 2030. And that majority of that needs to go in at the farm level, at the smallholder farm level, but also it needs to go into research. So there's kind of models out there. We need to be looking at and driving our agricultural research and our science now for where we want food to be in 10 years' time.
Yes.
Because where we are now is where it was 10 to 20 years back.
Yes.
And so, you know, there's groups like the CGIAR, which is a set of research networks around the world with thousands of scientists working on climate adaptation, you know, what's crops that will grow better in certain climates that are better for human health.
Yeah.
And so we have to invest in the future if we really want to shift this.
Yes.
Through research. We need to invest in the present at the farm level to help people to bring in new technologies that already exist around water, around using more improved crops, improving yields,
yep,
so that you're actually working at the same level to achieve more.
Yes.
Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
and there's a lot of science there. But, you know, you've still got in different parts of the world, people are still using cows to plow fields.
Yeah.
Like, even just simple stuff like access to tractors and mechanization is still a long way off in many parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, it's not simple. It's not just complex technologies. It's access issues.
Yes.
And then it's also around knowledge, you know. So if you have, like, I was talking to somebody who is doing a project that works on a tech platform to work with cattle and management of cattle in India.
Wow. Now,
if you can think of India and cows, there's obviously a connection there.
Yes.
But he provides veterinary services through a web-based application platform to improve the production of milk per cow.
Wow.
And it's just simple by just certain veterinary access, advice access,
yes,
via a mobile platform, which is super simple and effective.
Wow.
He can increase the yield of these cows dramatically, thus their income, reduce their emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's like technological interventions out there that can really be help us to move this forward. And
yes,
what we have to do is find ways to accelerate them.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's almost a show in itself if we talked about technology and food. My last question.
I know some people you could talk to about that.
Oh, please let me know so we can talk about it on the show. I'd love to. My last question before I let you go, Paul, is you know, we talked about some of the things you're working on next year in 2021. Like, what projects are you most excited to be working with in 2021 at this stage?
Yeah, I mean, so one of them I mentioned is the UN Food Systems Summit. I think this is a really key opportunity for 2021.
Yes.
To really bring together actors and really drive and punch through at the global level some new areas that we should invest in.
Yes.
So it's like having the right dialogue, getting the focus on that, and then finding countries which want to take that forward.
Yes.
And individuals and organizations and companies to make commitments around it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really, really critical.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, I think as we start to build back kind of and think outside of the post-COVID world, you know, this year's been very much about how do we deal with this new reality we're in.
Yes.
I think as we build out of that, there's an opportunity for rethinking about the connection, the invisible elements of the food system that mm-hmm. we previously didn't know about.
Yeah.
You know, the connection between nutrition and human health
mm-hmm.
Is really key. We, you know, people, it's very easy to forget that, you know, COVID came from a food system problem.
Yeah.
It came out of a market system where we pushed it to the brink.
Yes.
Under connections with nature.
Mm.
And so if we don't take this seriously, it actually undermines everything else.
100%.
You know, all the economic conversations, all the conversations about civil liberties, all of that, like, let's sort out our food and get that right so that there's people in the world not pressed into these extremes to try and feed themselves.
Yes.
And let's look at food safety, food security, all these issues. So I think, you know, as we do that alongside the Food System Summit, I think that's really great. The other thing that's coming up, you know, late next year, which people have kind of forgotten, is the World Expo in Dubai.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think that also creates another platform for kind of post-October going into 2022 of how do we talk about, come together, celebrate the diversity that we have globally,
yes.
But also think about food security as an element within that, and think about the richness of our food, but also how do we connect that back to the climate. And, you know, there's other events, the climate summit, there's a range of events happening next year, which are also quite significant.
Yes.
And so we're super excited about that and how we bring chefs into that conversation and how we bring others into that conversation.
It's going to be, it's going to be a big year, no doubt. I'm really excited to see what happens next for the organization, and feel really privileged to have yet another really great enlightening conversation with you, Paul. So thanks so much for your time. What's the best way that people can find out about everything you're doing so they can be involved and be part of the conversation with you?
Yeah. So, I would say, obviously on social media, you know, follow, I'm on social media, Paul Newnham, on most platforms. And there's also Chef's Manifesto. So if you look at the Chef's Manifesto, we share a lot of content, a lot of ideas through, particularly on Instagram for the Chef's Manifesto. If you're on Twitter, at the SDG2 Advocacy Hub is always sharing what's going on the global scene and getting the reports out there. And then Good Food for All is also another platform. So we have a few channels. They all have slightly different personalities according to different audiences. So depending on who's listening, that's where I would suggest.
Beautiful. And as always, those are linked up in the show notes, as well as the fantastic books that Paul talked about on the podcast. So thanks so much for the conversation, Paul. I've really enjoyed it.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, guys, I hope you really enjoyed that episode of the Open Pantry podcast. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. Now, as I was hinting at the start of the podcast, we were talking about Restoke, which is a fantastic back of house automation platform based here in Melbourne. Just fantastic piece of tech that's been developed last year. It's all about automating and delegating procedures and compliance, ordering and inventory management, prep runs, all those things at the back of the house, which we don't love to talk about, but we know as hospitality owners that are so, so critical to make sure that our venues run successfully. And on top of that, it has a live food costing system, which is just fantastic. I've seen it in person. Now, it's all about giving you the time to actually run your business much more effectively and see all these things live in your business when you're not there. So I know that's going to be really critically important as we rebuild this industry. Now, for the Open Pantry listeners, you're actually able to get 1 month free subscription on top of a normal 14 days trial. So that's about 6 weeks to use this platform and figure out if you actually like it. I know you actually will. So all you have to do is go to restoke.ai/theopenpantry. So that's restoke.ai/theopenpantry. Super easy. Check it out. You'll see everything you need to know about the platform itself. I know you're going to love it. And let me know what you think as well. Like, this is a fantastic product. I don't talk about products very much on the show, and these guys are just amazing what they're doing right now. So that's why I want to support them. So check it out and see what you think. And I'll talk to you on the next podcast.